This season of Power Corrupts is ad-free. I'm not going to tell you about overpriced socks or some random mortgage website. But if you want to support the show by helping to offset the costs of making Power Corrupts, there are two ways you can pitch in. First, pre-order my new book, Corruptible: Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us, which comes out on November 9th. If you like this podcast, I promise you'll love this book. Second, become a Patreon subscriber for just $3, euros, or pounds per month, and get access to exclusive bonus content and more. Go to patreon.com/powercorrupts. Thanks for listening and for your support.
The burned wreck of Daphne Caruana Galizia's car lies in a Maltese field, flung over a wall by an explosion which killed the crusading journalist.
53-year-old Caruana Galizia was famous for leading the Panama Papers investigation into corruption in Malta. She also ran a hugely popular blog in which she relentlessly focused on cases of alleged high-level corruption targeting politicians from across party lines.
Her assassination may have silenced her, but the questions she was asking, they haven't gone away.
Some of her allegations were based on revelations in the so-called Panama Papers leak in 2015. Over 11 million documents gave details of the personal financial...
On October 16, 2017, Daphne Caruana Galizia was driving near her home in her Peugeot 108 when a car bomb exploded, killing her instantly. The explosion was so powerful that the car splintered into pieces, which were blown far away from the blast site. The remains of the investigative journalist were discovered nearly 80 meters away. Galizia's killers had been stalking her, staying up until 2 a.m. watching her through a long-lens telescope, smoking Rothman's red cigarettes, and throwing the finished cigarette butts into water bottles so they wouldn't leave a trace. They'd been paid 30,000 euros up front. Initially, they'd considered killing her with a sniper rifle, but they decided a bomb would be better. On the night of October 15th, Galizia made a fateful decision to park her car outside rather than inside her garage. It gave her assassins an opening. They wired up a bomb with a SIM card, so all they had to do was text a certain phone number and it would detonate. She lost her life exposing corruption. Who killed this anti-corruption crusader and why? The answers lie with a crooked law firm in a tiny Central American country, a world-changing leak of documents about shell companies, and two journalists who work day and night to expose the secret financial lives of the world's rich and powerful. I'm Brian Kloss, and you're listening to Power Corrupts, the podcast where we shine a light on the hidden and often nefarious forces that shape our world. Today, we're continuing our exploration of tax havens, illicit hubs of dark money that dot the globe, often in backwater paradises, seemingly tucked far away from the battles of geopolitics. And yet, as we'll see today, these tax havens implicate some of the world's most powerful people in shady business dealings that they pay top dollar to hide. And one place that they hide their riches is in Panama.
America's link between the Atlantic and the Pacific is her most important highway of the sea. 5 miles of land on either side of the canal is American territory. And today, into the hills that sweep the whole 47-mile length of the waterway, her troops are on guard. Every day they're rehearsing what would happen if any foreign power dared to attack this part of America.
When the Panama Canal opened in 1914, it helped put the small Central American nation at the center of global trade. Roughly 15,000 ships pay hefty sums to pass through it each year, allowing them to bypass the two-week journey around South America. It's basically an express lane. But while Panama is known for its canal, it should be equally known for its legal infrastructure, which has given the world's rich and super rich the chance to bypass something else, their own national tax laws. If the canal is the global fast lane for shipping, Panama's tax haven is one of the globe's fast lanes to escape from the tax man. Tax havens have been around for just about as long as humans have been levying taxes. Whenever governments try to raise revenue, smart, powerful people try to come up with innovative ways to avoid them. In ancient Greece, a few Greek islands even developed themselves as early tax havens of sorts, as they became repositories for trading goods offshore from Athens, where there was a new 2% levy being raised. In short, tax havens are nothing new, but they've become much more sophisticated and much more central to international financial flows. To understand how sophisticated, how central, and how it all works, we're going to leave Panama for a moment and travel a few thousand miles away to the Middle East.
It was the year of people power, of revolution.
Something I've never seen before, a phalanx of men on horseback and on camels.
And bloodshed that doomed dictators.
No one's going home. No one's going to go home.
When the Arab Spring swept across the Middle East in 2011, Syria was thrown into turmoil. With pro-democracy protests sweeping the country and a civil war about to break out, Western governments began to take a closer look at the regime's money flows. And the more they looked, the more they saw that a regime insider named Rami Makhlouf was the central artery when it came to Syrian corruption. Everything dodgy flowed through him. But like any self-respecting corrupt bagman for a dictator, Makhlouf operated a lot of his illicit activities through a nondescript shell company, a firm called Drex Technologies SA. It was registered in the British Virgin Islands, a notorious tax haven that's long been favored for those who want to stash some cash with people who won't ask too many questions. For anyone who understands how crooked rich people tend to operate, this shell company came as no surprise. It's just shady business as usual. But there was still a mystery here. How had one of the most corrupt henchmen for a Syrian dictator managed to make his illicit wealth look legitimate? How had a corrupt crony of one of the world's worst dictators managed to dot all the I's and cross all the T's on his paperwork in the BVI? More specifically, who was helping him? That's the question that intrigued Vice journalist Ken Silverstein the most, so he decided to find out. As he reported back in 2014, shell companies like Drex Technologies can't exist unless they have a registered agent on some paperwork, which in this case effectively acted as the legitimate frontman for illicit gains stolen from Syria's people. Silverstein found that the frontman in this case, the registered agent for Drex, was a Panamanian law firm called Mossack Fonseca. Silverstein's expose in Vice accused Mossack Fonseca of being a law firm that legitimized shell companies for oligarchs, criminals, and other powerful rich figures across the world, not just for the henchmen in Syria's dictatorship. And it apparently touched a bit of a nerve. The niece of Ramon Fonseca, one of the law firm's founders, commented below Silverstein's article, quote, "I live guilt-free, and I don't give a damn, all you people making fun of my uncle and of Panama. We're a happy country where nobody works because you bring your dirty money here. LOL, we just spend it. Your governments are the ones making crimes. We're just lawyers and we don't care. Panama is the happiest country in the world." A few years later, Panama might have been happy, but the party at Mossack Fonseca was about to come to an abrupt end. On March 9, 2016, employees at Mossack Fonseca realized something had gone very wrong. Someone who had access to the company's files had copied them, pretty much all of them, 11.5 million documents. And the person who copied those files, a person who called himself or herself only John Doe, decided to get in touch with two journalists with a tantalizing offer.
So my name is Bastian Obermeier, and I work as an investigative reporter for Süddeutsche Zeitung.
I'm Frederick Obermeier. I also work as an investigative reporter for the German daily Süddeutsche Zeitung, and I'm not related to Bastian, just for the record.
No brothers, not married, just colleagues.
One day, they got contacted by John Doe. The anonymous individual claimed that their life was in danger because they'd copied a huge treasure trove of data related to Mossack Fonseca. Internal emails, financial statements, the entire inner workings of a company that exists primarily to keep other people's secrets. The leak seemed too good to be true, at least at first.
But many people tend to be a little, you know, to boast about what they've got. So we just looked into it, and in the beginning, it didn't seem huge, right?
No, not at all. When I first looked into the documents, I thought that it would be one or two or half a dozen good leads and possibly good stories. But then more and more data came in. We received more and more data. It was more and more gigabytes. And in the end, we turned out with 2.6 terabytes of data.
If that sounds like a lot of data to you, that's because it is. WikiLeaks, for comparative purposes, was just 1.7 gigabytes worth of data. So this was 1,500 times bigger.
And that's still an amount of data that I'm not able to fully explain. I have heard different explanations now, read different explanations. It's from hundreds of truckloads full of printed paper. I also heard something about a huge stack of paper nearly reaching the moon and stuff like that. But I don't know what is right. But for me, it was a lot, and it was by far too much information for the two of us.
Bastian and Frederick set to work. First things first, they had to verify the authenticity of the documents. And after lots of sleuthing, it seemed that everything checked out. They became confident that John Doe wasn't just for real, but that he'd also taken enormous risks to expose a company that was doing the dirty work for some truly powerful and truly dangerous people. And the more they dug into the documents, the more they realized what they were dealing with: an explosive leak that could change the world.
I think the moment that we realized that the best friend of Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, was in there, and he was connected to four or five companies where $2 billion were routed through, coming from state banks in Russia, we thought, okay, this is going to be really big. So this is going to have a global impact, this one story.
What they were seeing, one email, one spreadsheet, one financial statement at a time, was the way the pros hide their money. And they were pulling back the curtain on a world that was by design shrouded in secrecy. For both journalists, it quickly became an obsession.
It may sound boring going through millions of documents, but it isn't. It became an addiction. You started, stumble across one interesting document, then you read more and more, and you find more and more traces, and you click through the next document. And by doing so, hours and hours passed. There were so many nights when I only wanted to read one document before going to bed. One became 10, then it was 100 pages, and soon the sun going up and it was morning. And I've basically lost my sense for time.
Whenever Fredrik and me started to look for a story in the night, in the documents, we found one. Because there were just so many people doing shady things. So, and whatever you type in art deal, you type in soccer, you type in whatever you found in the first month, you found a new story. I mean, how can you stay away from this trove of documents if you know once you start, you're going to find a good story?
Late into the night and sometimes into the next morning, Frederick and Bastian started to piece everything together. And in all those documents, a vivid underworld of criminality was coming to life. To give you an example of what they were starting to uncover, Bastian explains what a sort of standard case would look like.
My example is always, if you go ahead and you want to smuggle like arms and pistols and whatever to Africa, and you go and buy a boat and put all the arms in the boat, and then the police stops you, they find out that you are the owner because you bought it. So what you're going to do as a criminal is you buy an anonymous offshore company, and that offshore company buys the boat. And this is exactly what people do with offshore company. They use it because you can hide your traces there. So there are numerous cases where police around the world stop boats or crimes or other things and try to find out who's behind it. And then you got an offshore company like Red Blue Limited that has been founded by Mossack Fonseca, that Panamanian law firm whose records we obtained. And they just don't give away the name of the beneficial owner, of the person behind the company. They just say, yeah, it's right, the boat is owned by Red Blue Limited.
Mossack Fonseca acted like a legitimizer and a shield. First, it made everything look like it was above board. And then, when authorities did start poking around, Mossack Fonseca blocked law enforcement queries by refusing to hand over sensitive information about their clients.
That was their business model. The business model was secrecy. And this is why the leak was so important. What Mossack Fonseca and many other offshore providers sold for decades was secrecy. And we could look behind the curtain and we could tell everything. We had all the documents that they had. So we knew the beneficial owners of thousands of companies. The exact thing that they promised everyone, no one would ever know.
Bastian and Frederic realized that what they had was too big, too vast to uncover alone. So they turned to the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, a global network of top-notch reporters, to see if they'd be willing to coordinate the project of fully understanding the Panama Papers. And even though we know now that this story was huge, at the time, Bastian and Frederic weren't sure that others would see the significance of what they were looking at.
Retrospectively, it sounds ridiculous because we really prepared a very big elevator pitch to ICIJ. So we wrote down every lead that we could find. We focused on finding as many leads from as many different continents as possible to show the international, the global perspective. We were really fearful that the ICIJ might not be interested in it, because at least my fear was that they might say, well, it's just another offshore company revelation. And for us, it was already clear that it was not just another one. It was the offshore leak. It was the one leak where you could basically see every aspect or every consequence that this industry has for all of us. So when we then pitched it to ICIJ, and I still remember ICIJ's director, Gerard Ryle, and his face, and I would say he has a very good poker face, and yeah. I still cannot read him, but despite this, we still saw him like this little smile, this little hint that we got him, that we already could recognize his interest. He was still like very calm and diplomatic and didn't want to give us too much hope, but we could already feel like, yes, he got the bait. We have him.
Soon, the investigation went worldwide. 107 media organizations in 80 countries began poring over the documents. That was crucial, because names that meant nothing to Bastian and Frederic meant quite a lot to local journalists who were realizing that plenty of heads of state and other senior figures from business, sports, politics, even internationally known celebrities, you name it, were popping up in the leaked documents.
We found in the first weeks, it was like we had our own little competition who found the most heads of states. We found leads to 75 heads of states or something like that. And it was like, you Google the name. I don't know who was head of state in Paraguay 15 or 20 or 30 years ago. And you find, you know, the wife of Hugo Banza or something. And you Google the name Hugo Banza and you say, oh, he was the head of Paraguay. He used to be some kind of dictator even. So that's going to be probably of interest for our colleagues.
Some seriously powerful people were about to be seriously upset that their private financial dealings, their efforts to avoid taxes or engage in illegal or unethical activity, were about to be exposed. So Bastian, Frederic, and others involved in the investigation went to extreme lengths to make sure that the data couldn't be erased or stolen by malicious actors who were trying to protect their secrets. At their newsroom in Germany, the two journalists helped set up a system in which the data was stored on air-gapped computers, computers that can never connect to the internet, in a data room that only a few people were authorized to access. To ensure that they'd know if someone managed to sneak into the room to access or tamper with the data in any way, they painted the screws that held the hard drives in place with glittery nail polish, so it would be obvious if they'd been unscrewed. DataSecure, the international army of journalists, combed through the documents carefully. And as they did so, they realized that Mossack Fonseca had inadvertently helped them connect the dots a lot faster.
Mossack Fonseca did us, in my opinion, a very big favor. They discussed a lot what was going on in their daily business. They sent around articles, is this that guy? They discussed if it is a good idea to do business with a Mexican member of a drug cartel. They discussed if it is a good idea to do business with the cousin of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. They even had their bosses involved in the discussion. Should we keep that guy as a customer? And they said, yeah, well, this bank is keeping him as a customer. Oh, but he's sanctioned. Oh, no, let's go on doing business with him. We had them internally debating if it's a good idea to do business with this Russian pedophile who already was in the news for running a pedophile ring, where there was already investigators approaching Mossack Fonseca to learn more about it. And still they went on. But you had it all documented internally. You had a first piece of the puzzle, then a second, then a third in the data, and then you started to search outside. And soon after a certain point in time, you saw the bigger picture. This was so helpful. And many of our colleagues who have worked on such leaks before and after in those days telling us, like, this was the best organized leak. And it was not due to us, but it was due to Mossack Fonseca, because they had a very good organizational structure that was helping us a lot to understand what they are doing.
Bastian chalks this up to some national stereotypes about the notorious bureaucratic efficiency and thoroughness of German and Swiss record keepers.
Which may have been partly to the fact that Jürgen Mossack, one of the founders, was a German guy.
Oh, come still on, lives, the stereotypes again.
And he was born in here in Bavaria, and he hired a Swiss guy, Mr. Zollinger, to bring real order in their business, in their accounting. And so what they did in the end of the 90s, the beginning of the zero years, they digitalized their whole system, their whole, you know, when they had a documents on paper printed out in the 80s, they scanned it away and put it real orderly in one document, in one folder. And that was really fantastic to work with. So we had documents to 250,000 offshore companies.
Some of the documents defied belief. Because you needed to have a name on paperwork related to the shell companies, part of the game for companies like Mossack Fonseca was finding placeholder names to use that didn't implicate their clients in the running of these entities that existed merely to hide financial activity.
And I think what is even more important, it already showed the tricks they are using. The customers and the enablers, like companies like Mossack Fonseca, and also huge banks used when they helped their customers to set up such companies. It showed that they are internally using names like Winnie the Pooh or Harry Potter to leave no traces in a paper form. It showed that there is women and men, in this case in Panama, who live in very poor villages out there in the countryside, but who are on the paper directors of thousands of companies all around the world. Companies that are involved in scandals in many, many countries. It showed that even dead people are at least on the paper still signing documents, because this is one common trick that was used and nobody took care that the one person that was already dead.
As they continued to dig, it quickly became clear that the majority of individuals who had hired Mossack Fonseca to construct a cloud of secrecy around their finances are what I would call the global invisible rich. People with tons of cash, often from corrupt, illicit, or unethical profits, but with names that you've never heard of before. They made their riches while avoiding the spotlight. And they wanted to keep it that way, all while avoiding taxes or questions about the source of their enormous wealth. But for other cases, Bastian and Frederic saw that there was a public interest in the documents and in the revelations that they contained. One such case involved the Prime Minister of Iceland at the time, Sigmundur David Gunnlaugsson.
We had very little documentation about the Prime Minister of Iceland, but we saw that he was the secret owner of an offshore company.
That was enough to raise red flags. What was the Prime Minister doing with an offshore company that was being arranged and organized by Mossack Fonseca? So they kept digging.
Then we spoke to our Icelandic colleague on the ground there, And he found out that the prime minister held the shares of three big Icelandic banks who went bankrupt in the big financial crisis. And he did not tell anyone.
There was a good reason he didn't want anyone knowing that he had a direct financial interest in Iceland's banks. And that's because he was the politician who was himself in charge of bailing out Iceland's banks during the financial crisis.
He was sitting on both sides of the table, because on the one side, he was negotiating as the prime minister that, you know, all the people who were owning shares should get money. And he was one of those, but he didn't make that public.
Little did the prime minister know that his secrets were about to come out.
Panama's carnival attracts visitors from around the world. But away from the lights, this place is a thriving tax haven. Investors come to Panama for secrecy.
لتعمل تلك الشركات في دول أخرى وهذا النوع من الشركات يسمى offshore.
New revelations on how the rich and the powerful hide cash are rocking countries around the world. The so-called Panama Papers contain allegations of money laundering and tax evasion. They have sparked investigations.
Provenant des archives du cabinet panaméen Mossack Fonseca, une compagnie spécialisée dans la domiciliation de sociétés offshore.
A vast number of confidential documents have been leaked, allegedly showing how the world's rich and powerful hide their money. More than 11 million files were obtained from a Panama-based offshore law firm that's been operating for nearly 40 years.
I think the first time I really realized what the Panama Papers mean and what impact they could potentially have was when it was already out there. When it was on our website, when the service of our newspaper broke down for a moment because it was users from all around the world trying to read articles, even German articles. And when we had our email inbox flowing over with emails from journalists, individuals from all around the world, when we saw CNN, BBC, Al Jazeera, all picking up the Panama Papers, Los Papeles de Panama. That was the moment when I thought, okay, this is really big. And this was also a very shocking moment, because still knowing that it all started with our rather small newspaper here in the south of Germany, that was amazing feeling, but also a little bit frightening, and it's still frightening.
We went into a tunnel in the moment we published, and we didn't get out there like for 14 days, I'd say.
I'm still trying to remember that time. It's really hard because I have something like a blackout. There is not that much that I can remember. I can only remember driving home that night after we had already pushed the publish button, after the printing machines were running. And it was about midnight. I drove home on my bicycle and called my wife. We discussed what was happening, and she was sitting in front of the TV, and she was like, whoa, the stuff that you worked on in the past month, and was really not an easy time because I worked a lot day and night. But she was like, it's everywhere. It's literally in every news show, there's something on the Panama Papers.
Tell me about when you opened your inbox, what it was like checking your email right after the Panama Papers were published.
We could see the emails just running down the screen. So we tried to answer one email and to pick it up. And then the phone rang, we looked away and we went back to the screen and the email was gone because it already had run down the screen. So it was on the next page. It was crazy.
That was just the beginning. Once the floodgates opened, the questions all flowed out across the world. The Prime Minister of Iceland even stormed out during an interview in which a journalist put him on the spot about his dealings in offshore shell companies. Dealings that were secret until the Panama Papers exposed them.
Have you or did you have any connections yourself to an offshore company?
Myself, no. Well, Icelandic companies, and I have worked for Icelandic companies, had connections with offshore companies, even
Soon, the protests began. Ordinary people were seeing the previously hidden outlines of the financial system that protected the global super-rich, and they were understandably upset at the hypocrisy. Protests quickly spread to 5 countries in the hours after the papers were published. But the biggest ones of all were in Iceland.
There were like 30,000 people in Reykjavik in Iceland hitting the streets and throwing bananas in yogurt to the prime minister's office. I can understand why they would throw bananas, because you can really throw it really good. You know, it's good in your hand. But why would you throw yogurt? I don't get that one. But that's their thing.
The demonstrations in Iceland, that was really amazing, because I think for an US audience, one has to say it sounds potentially small for a US audience to have several thousand people on the streets protesting. But for Iceland, which is a very small but amazing country, it was the biggest demonstration in history. So this was basically the one demonstration that everyone will remember, even in the future. And I even heard rumors that they will have it in their history books. So that's like, hey, and this was due to this one person, this one whistleblower, who reached out to us offering some information, some data, and some information turned out to be, at least at that point, the biggest leak in journalism history.
The first casualty of the Panama Papers has fallen. Sigmundur David Gunnlaugsson, the Prime Minister of Iceland, yielded his post on Tuesday amid public uproar that he failed to disclose links to an offshore company in a Caribbean tax haven. The shakeup stems from media reports based on the leak of more than 11 million documents from the Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca. The leak detailed a vast network of shell companies.
The revelations kept coming, from shell companies linked to drug cartels to world-renowned cellists in Vladimir Putin's inner circle. This is from a BBC Panorama report shortly after the Panama Papers were published.
We believe we have found a billion-dollar laundering operation in Russia. This man, cellist Sergei Roldugin, a close friend of President Putin, was officially the owner of two secretive companies which benefited from suspicious deals. For example, an offshore company borrows $6 million. 3 months later, the loan is written off for just $1.
What truly defies belief is that Jürgen Mossack, one of the founders of Mossack Fonseca, denied any knowledge of any of these shady characters who were their clients. At times, he may have even been telling the truth, because that was the entire point. No questions asked. Here he is speaking to Eamon Javers of CNBC in 2016.
Did you know that Vladimir Putin's aides and associates were using the services of Mossack Fonseca?
No.
Did you know that 8 members of the Chinese Politburo were using your services?
No, of course not.
Did you know that David Cameron's family had used your services?
No.
And why not, sir? I mean, your name is on the front door here. Wouldn't that be something that you would want to know as the business owner?
Whenever we find out through the media, and that's how it normally happens, that there could be somebody, a personally exposed person, behind a company that was formed by us for a professional intermediary, then we start investigating.
As journalists kept digging, they kept uncovering more and more skeletons too. Not just modern politicians, but also criminal secrets that had long been buried, but now were being unearthed, one leaked document at a time.
Britain's biggest ever robbery. Gold bars worth £30 million are stolen near Heathrow Airport.
Now we know Mossack Fonseca helped in the laundering of proceeds.
Britain, the world's biggest peacetime robbery ever. Armed men stormed a warehouse near London's Heathrow Airport. They tied up the guards, poured gasoline on them, and threatened to burn them to death. Then they left with 3 tons of gold and a quantity of diamonds.
In 1983, the so-called Brinksmat robbery was arguably the most audacious heist that had ever happened in Britain. British media dubbed it the crime of the century. The criminals who stole the gold melted it down and sold it. But nobody was ever really sure where that huge pile of cash ended up, until the Panama Papers. According to reporting from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, Mossack Fonseca set up a Panamanian shell company called Fiberian Inc. 16 months after the heist. Jürgen Mossack himself was one of the signatories on the paperwork. And like a good German record keeper, to continue with the stereotype suggested by Bastian, Mossack even decided to document the origins of the shell company's assets, writing that the company was, quote, apparently involved in the management of money from the famous theft from Brinksmat in London. The company itself has not been used illegally, but it could be that the company invested money through bank accounts and properties that were illegitimately sourced. End quote. Mossack Fonseca continues to deny any wrongdoing related to the Brinksmack case. So what are we to make of the broader significance of the Panama Papers? Sure, the leak took down politicians and it exposed crooks. But isn't it just the tip of the iceberg? Isn't it just a little glimpse of this parallel world, this second system that exists only for those who can pay to access it?
Yes, I think the Panama Papers have shown what many individuals and people out there had already suspected. The Panama Papers have shown that there is a parallel world with a very huge entrance fee, because administering and setting up such a company is quite expensive, especially if we want separate layers of secrecy. And I think it showed what also the consequences, because if we try to understand what it means having a parallel world, it means that in this world, the riches decide which laws they stick to and to which not. They decide, oh, this law, also it was passed by the German parliament, I don't like it. I use a loophole to bypass that law. And if we think that one further, that's a huge problem for democracy. If there is one part of society that can decide which rules he or she sticks to and which not. If you like search for a very extreme example, it means that there's individuals who say, hey, I want to rob banks, and I will find a way that I can rob banks without being caught. I will find a country where robbing banks is still legal, and then I will do it.
There are plenty of true crime podcasts and plenty of news stories about people who steal or people who rob banks. Those criminals endlessly fascinate us. But bank robbers are insignificant minnows compared to the big fish of stealing, the kinds of people who were clients of companies like Mossack Fonseca. According to estimates from three economists in 2017, up to 10% of the total output of all economies in the world is stashed in offshore tax havens. That would represent about $800 billion, billion with a B, in lost revenue to governments around the world. That's a lot of bank robberies. And because the deck is stacked against the global poor with just about everything to do with international economics and finance, the world's poorest countries are yet again the ones who lose out the most. The countries that most desperately need the cash are the very ones who usually don't get the taxes that they're owed. So which countries are tax havens? Panama, of course, is one of them. But it's just one of many. The European Union's current tax haven blacklist includes American Samoa, Dominica, Fiji, Guam, Palau, Samoa, Trinidad and Tobago, the US Virgin Islands, Vanuatu, and the Seychelles. But that list has been criticized for not including some of the key names in tax havens and shell companies, like the British Virgin Islands, the Cayman Islands, the Isle of Man, Switzerland, and yes, even the United States. As many experts in the world of secretive finance have pointed out, several U.S. states, like Delaware, Nevada, North Dakota, and Wyoming, to name just a few, make it extremely easy to set up a shell company. If powerful Western countries want to get serious about cracking down on tax havens, they've got plenty of work to do closer to home. But also because the COVID-19 pandemic has drawn down the coffers of most governments, governments that badly need to reap all the tax money that they're owed.
Now we have the COVID-19 crisis. We have governments spending huge amounts of money to pay for vaccination, to cope with the crisis, to keep companies flowing and alive, and to pay for people who lost their jobs during this crisis. But it also, what we have seen in this parallel world, means that there's a bunch of people who don't contribute their fair share, meaning taxes, to help us, all of us. People on Main Street are paying for this cost, but those people in the parallel offshore world, they are not paying their fair share. And I think that's also a problem, and that's an even bigger problem the more and the longer this crisis lasts.
The Panama Papers are the beginning, not the end, of the offshore tax haven story. The leak provided by John Doe and then publicized by Bastian, Frederick, and hundreds of other journalists has made it plain to everyone that this parallel world exists. It's real. Our politicians are allowing it to continue to exist, often because many of them, or their families, or their business associates, or their donors, benefit directly from that parallel secret world. And it's a policy choice. It has to be. After all, do you really think that the US or the UK or the European Union couldn't put more pressure on the geopolitical superpowers of Vanuatu or Palau if they really wanted to? Now, more than 5 years later, not enough has been done to tackle tax havens. And there's still one central mystery that remains unanswered. Who is John Doe? I had to ask Frederick and Bastien about it.
You must have in your head a sort of mental image of who John Doe is. Do you think about that? And do you hope that someday you'll end up, you know, getting a note at work saying, meet me at the bar outside. I want to finally shake your hand or chat about what you've been through together, even though you've never met?
As a curious individual, I really hope for that moment. I really hope that there once in my lifetime, there will be this one moment when a person is approaching me, and we have, I must admit, we have a way how we will basically be able to identify if it's really John Doe. And I would really like to drink a beer or two or even more with this amazing individual, because it's an individual who did so much for society, in my opinion. And I want to hear what happened after the Panama Papers, how difficult it must have been to keep the secrets to friends and not being able to tell friends, hey, this one John Doe guy, that's me, the guy behind the Panama Papers. So that's the one side. But on the other hand side, as a journalist and as a professional, there's also this voice telling me like, no, it's a bad idea meeting and knowing more about John Doe, because we still live in a time where whistleblowers do not have enough protection, where whistleblowers are forced into exile, are put on trail, and basically have a bad life because of the good deeds that they have done for society. So I think it was the best thing John Doe could do, not revealing the identity when he approached us. Because still, you could put a pistol to my head and I would not be able to reveal the identity because I don't know it. So I think that's the best thing a whistleblower could do. And I must add, unfortunately, because I would hope for better protection for a whistleblower that would then enable me to sit down with John Doe and have a nice drink and speaking about the old times. And old times, hey, it's only 5 years ago, but still it feels like a very long time.
If the real John Doe does ever get in touch, Frederick and Bastien have already established a secret code with him or her to make sure it's the real John Doe and not some imposter.
So that's not a problem. We're not gonna forget that.
We started this episode with the assassination of Daphne Caruana Galizia, that brave journalist in Malta. If you're interested in her story, you should check out the Daphne Project, which harnessed the investigative powers of 45 journalists working across borders to complete her investigative work and to uncover the truth about her murder. Earlier this year, a man named Vincent Muscat pleaded guilty to her murder. A wealthy property and energy tycoon named Jorgen Fennec has been accused of masterminding the plot. A taxi driver has been accused of being a go-between, helping to orchestrate the assassination. And even the Prime Minister of Malta was forced to resign after serious allegations emerged that members of his entourage were complicit in the assassination plot. It's a tragic story about the extent that powerful people are willing to go to silence those who would expose their criminality and their corruption. And that, more than anything, is one of the tragic legacies of the Panama Papers. They exposed a hidden world of wealthy people playing by different rules from the rest of us. But the secrets we saw, the ones that Bastien and Frederick helped expose, were just from one law firm. We can be certain that there's far more, hiding somewhere below the surface, waiting for the next John Doe, the next Daphne Caruana Galizia, the next Frederick Obermeier and Bastien Obermeier to be brave enough to expose them. Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode or learned something new, please rate and review the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen. And if you're feeling really generous, tell your friends about the show, post about it on social media, or support the show more directly by pre-ordering my new book, Corruptible: Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us, or by becoming a Patreon subscriber at patreon.com/powercorrupts. In the next episode, we're going to leave the world of offshore finance and instead explore parts of the internet that you probably haven't thought much about: the Internet of Things. And we'll uncover how hackers could cause massive disruption, even kill huge numbers of people, by exploiting vulnerabilities in everything from cars to fish tanks to tea kettles. Don't miss it. This episode was written and narrated by me, Brian Kloss. The executive producer was George McDonough, who also did the sound editing. Music by Scott Holmes. Special thanks to Rachel DeAngelis, who helped research this episode. Goodbye for now.